This is Let's Talk Business with your host, Mark Ebinger. Now, here's Mark.
Welcome to Let's Talk Business, a show that highlights and promotes entrepreneurs to learn more about their vision, goals, and marketing strategy. Coming up on the show today, we're going to talk about the medical business of limb salvage and amputation prevention. In studio with us today is Dr. Jeffrey Martinez, a vascular surgeon at Espada Vascular here in San Antonio, who specializes in limb salvage and amputation prevention. Dr. Martinez, excited to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Mark. I always enjoy being able to get the message out about limb salvage and amputation prevention.
Well, I think San Antonio is like the diabetes capital of the world or something like that. So this is a good topic for San Antonians.
It is a heavily laden disease population in this part of the country.
Well, I hope it's not tied to Mexican food because I love my Mexican food.
I think you might be right.
Bummer. All right, I'm your host, Mark Ebinger, the owner of Krukus Virtual Staffing, a company that specializes in hiring virtual assistants from outside the United States.
I'm Kian Frith, the CEO of KV Impact Consulting. We're CFO specialists and cyber risk specialists, helping business owners realize their dreams.
Hi, guys. I'm Howie Nestel. I own Sharkmatic Advertising. I've been in marketing for 30 years. That's what I do to make a living. I love giving back and working in community projects, and that's what I do to make a life. So HowieNestel.com and Sharkmatic.com. Come and visit.
A quick reminder to follow the Let's Talk Business podcast on all the major podcast platforms and social media where you can catch video versions of the show. You can get to everything easily by visiting our website at satalkradio.com. If you're going to be in the San Antonio area on Thursday, May 16th, be sure to join us at the next Let's Talk Business Mega Business Mixer. We're expecting 150 to 200 local businesses, business owners and entrepreneurs on site to mix, mingle, and connect with each other to do more business. You can get to all the information on our website at satalkradio.com. And a quick shout out to Allison Emmert and Jen Limon, the owners of Indigo Film Productions, for being one of the gold sponsors for our upcoming Let's Talk Business Mega Mixer. Allison and Jen have been on the podcast a couple of times. Indigo Film Productions will be doing the videography for the mixer, which is going to give, you know, it's really going to elevate the overall experience for the attendees, as well as provide lots of media content for us to promote on social media and for our future events that will be coming up. Every quarter, we're going to be doing a mixer. So we want to have great content to continue to promote that, and we appreciate what they're going to be doing. Indigo Films Productions, the client portfolio includes Harley-Davidson, KC Customs Homes, Keller Williams Heritage, and more. So if you're looking to create a video that captivates and converts audiences, reach out to Allison and Jen over at Indigo Film Productions. You can visit their website at indigofilmpro.com. or call them at 210-262-1408. That's 210-262-1408.
By the way, before you move on, as a marketer, everybody should be doing video. Everybody should be in the market for video. Talk to them because it's less expensive than it used to be.
Yeah, and you can multi-purpose it. You know what I mean? It's like when we do an event, I say, hey, look, I want all of the content. Give it all to me. No matter just what you guys do, I want all of it. Because there's things you can pull out of it. You can just kind of reuse it, get it over to your social media team, and then kick out all kinds of content. So excited about that. We're going to have a photographer that's going to be taken on the red carpet stretch. We're going to be taking pictures right there. You know, the stopping point, everybody coming in to stop, take some pictures. Nice. You guys will be working the line. I'll be working it there with you.
Oh, yeah. Looking forward to it. Everybody. Yeah. It'll be awesome.
Well, that's one of the differences in our podcast mixer, mega mixer, compared to other regular business mixers, is yet you have the podcast host introducing the attendees to each other so they can do business with each other. And that's what we did at the first one. And within a week, people called me and said, hey, thank you for that introduction. I'm actually doing business with so-and-so.
Yeah. And that's the whole point, right? The purpose of a mixer is to
mix and do business.
Love it.
Not just to eat and drink free food, which we'll have as well.
I laugh about this because it's like they pay $10, right, to get a ticket to come to the, which is, and all of that goes to a nonprofit. And there's like, they'll be drinking $20, $25 worth of margaritas, you know, within.
Oh, yeah. No, and then they'll leave and they're like, oh my God, I didn't get anything out of that. I didn't meet anybody. I'm like, because you were stuffing your face with cheap pizza. We're going to have better food, better drinks, and better attendees. Yep. If you don't do business, that's on you.
Yeah.
By the way, you mentioned the nonprofit, so we're going to be giving the money to Discovery Camps. It's a camp for kids battling cancer that's been around for 40 years. It's 100% free to the children and the families who attend and participate, and you could learn more at discoverycamps.org.
Yeah, it's going to be a massive event. It's going to be a lot of fun. All right, Dr. Martinez, So a little bit about your background. Of course, you're an MD, medical school at UT Health Science Center here in San Antonio, correct?
Correct.
Graduated in 1988?
I did.
Awesome. That's the year I got married, so 35 uh-huh. years. I know. Same woman. Wait, when you're a cop, you have to say that kind of stuff.
How many times?
No, just once.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you got to ask that, too.
That's funny. I knew a police officer I used to work with that he'd been married twice to the same girl. Actually, two of my friends. And did the same. I don't know.
To the same girl?
Yeah, to the same girl.
They were both married to the same girl.
Huh? No, to their own wives each time, not both guys married to one girl.
Sorry, times. a little side rabbit trail there. General surgery residency, followed by a 2-year fellowship in vascular surgery and additional training in endovascular surgery. Active duty U.S. Navy, served on USS Trenton and the USS Enterprise. Cool. And is a chief of vascular surgery at Portsmouth Naval Hospital. And he was a partner in a large vascular surgery group in San Antonio until he began to focus on peripheral artery disease of the legs, which is a thing here in San Antonio. So, Doc, just tell me a little bit about your, other than what I mentioned, kind of your background of what you did and how you ended up in where you're at now with the owning your own business.
Yeah, so I started out wanting to be a veterinarian. When I was probably in middle school, I had my best friend and I were sitting around one day, and he said, "We got to decide what we want to be when we grow up." And we decided that we wanted to do something outside because we always liked being outside doing stuff. And I thought, well, maybe a veterinarian because they take care of animals and we're outside. And I thought that was something to do. And I got a job with a veterinarian. And after a little bit of time, one of the veterinarians was pushing me towards medical school, just feeling that it would be a little more fulfilling. And so then I got a job at a hospital, and then I got to undergrad, and I was still planning on going to vet school. And that year, the vet school had changed their entrance examination from just the GRE to the MCAT, which was the same as what you have to take from medical school. And I scored pretty well on it, and and all my friends were going to medical school, and at that last minute, I switched over and went to medical school and didn't look back. So that's how I got to medical school. I liked mostly surgical procedures, just going through my rotations in medical school. That was something that I was attracted to. I think the thing that I really didn't like was in a lot of the surgical specialties, you have a patient, you come in, you treat them surgically, you fix them, they go home, and then that's it. You may never see them mm-hmm. again. You may see them for something else down the road, but generally it's a short visit. What attracted to me about vascular surgery is that patients, you don't cure the disease. It's like a cancer. It's going to be with them, and so they become your patients, and you get to develop a relationship with those patients, and you get to know them and what seems to work for them, what doesn't work for them. And so over the years, they become part of your practice, and I enjoy that part of it. It's a little tougher sometimes because you're sharing some of their disappointments with them, and that can be tough, but I like it, and I like the things that we do. I was classically trained as a vascular surgeon. At the time that I trained, there weren't very many of these minimally invasive procedures. In fact, Dr. Julio Palmaz, one of the inventors of the stent, was here in San Antonio, and he used to come to our vascular conferences looking for patients to, hey, can we put a stent in this patient? And our staff guys were, oh, no, you don't want to do that. You put a stent in there, you're going to just create plaque to dislodge. It's going to be worse. And so I remember when he finally got to put one in and how that the patient actually did well. So by the time I was doing my vascular training, they were just starting to incorporate more of these skills. The technology changed. We had smaller wires and balloons and things that we could use in the leg. And so I went off to the Navy, did my time in the Navy, came back, joined this group, went off for 3 months to do some additional training in these kind of procedures. And as we did more and more, I got involved in some clinical trials, looking at different things. And to me, it's really the space in vascular disease that needs more attention because we don't have the best tools for it. We have some very good tools and treatments, but we're not really where we need to be. And so it's really important that we keep working in this space, trying to develop new techniques, new medications, new treatments. And in San Antonio, we have a large population of diabetics that put them at risk for this. We have a large population of patients that really don't understand, because a lot of doctors don't even understand. And so you become an advocate for them and for their patient's treatment. And we need good people out there that are going to assume that responsibility and take care of these folks because they need somebody.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a lot of people, both, you know, civilians or patients, and like you said, even in the medical community, understand the implications of not really taking care of your vascular system. You hear about other things, right, much more often. Mm-hmm. But this is one that, you know, when we had our pre-meeting and I was looking at it, I'm like, oh, yeah, this is a big deal.
You know, it's funny. I've had a podiatrist in South Texas who I was calling because I had never seen this referral doctor before for a patient with a bad toe. And she at that time told me, she said, well, I really don't want to send you patients unless they're really bad because I don't want to waste your time. And that's kind of like, well, but that's what I'm here for. I'm not wasting time. Mm-hmm. And I've had primary care doctors in town who said, I've been in practice for 20, 25 years. I don't really see this. To me, that's like, well, you're not probably really weren't looking because it's here. So it needs more awareness. And all we can do is keep trying to educate.
So what motivated you to focus on the peripheral arterial disease?
Mostly because a lot of these newer techniques were coming out, newer things that we could treat. And I just gravitated towards wanting to do that more and more. And I think that's really...
So what is it you do for that? How do you figure out somebody's got an issue, and then what do you do about it?
Sure. So really, it's patients with atherosclerosis, poor circulation, blocked arteries, whatever you want to call it in the legs. And patients usually present in different ways, but there's three main ways they present. One is what we call intermittent claudication. And so that's when they go for a walk and they can't walk because their legs start to cramp up, one leg or the other. In the thigh or the calf is most common, but not everybody has that kind of classic symptom. And they will tell you that I can walk two blocks, and after two blocks, my leg starts to hurt, and then another block, I got to stop and rest, my leg feels good, I can walk again. Or they'll tell you, I can walk from the parking lot into HEB, and when I get to HEB, I got to rest. But it's very reproducible. So they will tell you that it's always this amount. Now, if you're going uphill, you're carrying some things, you're exerting yourself a little more, then those symptoms may come on sooner. And it's basically just that the muscles in the lower extremities are not getting enough blood flow. And so they're giving up on you. Some people just have extreme fatigue and can't move on. So their symptoms can be a little different, but it's generally very, very reproducible. Symptoms from the back can also give very similar symptoms. So that's something we have to elicit because there's a lot of back pain too. And is this really a back problem or is this a circulation problem? So that's the intermittent claudication is one group. Rest pain is another, where their circulation is bad enough that they have constant pain, usually in the foot. It's usually on the top of the foot because that is the furthest from your heart. So that's going to be the most ischemic area when the blood flow is poor. It can frequently be just at nighttime when they're in bed. When you're laying flat, you have no effective gravity. Your heart rate, your blood pressure are the lowest. So that will be when your pressure is the lowest, and that may be when your foot hurts. And you will have patients tell you that I sleep with my feet hanging over the edge of the bed, or I sleep in a recliner, so my feet are hanging down, or I have to get up. So it's that's what we call rest pain. So pain at rest or nocturnal rest pain. It's at nighttime. So that's another way they present. And then the last way is with tissue loss. So they may have an ulcer. You know, doc, I don't know how this came up. I looked at my foot and I had the sore. It was hurting me, and it's not healing up. It's getting worse. Becomes gangrene, similar to the person you were talking about, mm-hmm. a friend of yours earlier, that all of a sudden they have a bad toe and now they're looking at losing their leg. So the rest pain and the tissue loss, ulcers or gangrene, are what we call critical limb ischemia, and that's a form of peripheral arterial disease that's really very severe. So, you know, it's estimated that I brought some stats here mm-hmm. for you guys, but there's out of that, let's see, where are we? There's about 1 to 3 million Americans that suffer from that out of about 8.5 that have PAD. Now, those numbers are based on some old statistics, and there's been some new researchers here recently that have come out and said that number of actual PAD may be closer to 20 to 24 million people. So this number could be 3 times as high, which would not surprise me based on the amount of diabetes and all that we have. And so that form of PAD or the peripheral arterial disease is what's really bad. And if you look down at some of these others where they think the American Society or the Society for Vascular Surgery and the American Heart Association believe that 25% of patients with this, what we call critical limb ischemia, undergo an amputation within a year of the diagnosis. And that number may be 40% if they don't seek any treatment at all. So that's a really high number.
Well, who's at risk for this?
So the risk factors are age. So folks that are, once you get above age 50, their risk is about 5%. Over the age of 60, it can be 12 to 20%. So age definitely is a risk factor. Smoking, tobacco use clearly accelerates the development of plaque. So tobacco use is a biggie. Diabetics, that accelerates the plaque development, especially in the lower extremities below the knees. They have a pattern of disease where it's really mostly below the knee. You can have perfectly looking clean vessels until you get below the knee, and then it's just devastating the amount of disease and blockage they may have. So we have age, smoking, diabetes. If you have heart disease, you're more at risk. If you have kidney failure, you're more at risk. High blood pressure, high cholesterol, all of those are risk factors. But the biggest are your age, your smoking history, and diabetes.
I'm kind of fascinated in the fact that I was looking at some of these numbers before we came on air. And just from my experience of coming from the UK to the US in the last sort of 7-8 months, and just seeing the way that people eat and exercise or don't exercise, is a lot of what is happening here because of people not eating well. They're not exercising well. And so it's then become a build-up of circumstance. They haven't really looked after themselves. You know, like here in San Antonio, we eat an awful lot of I've been eating a lot of Mexican food. I mean, it tastes really good, but I presume it's not terribly healthy for us. And find that balance. Is diet and exercise a part of all of this?
Sure it is. Some of it's genetics. Some folks are more predisposed. Clearly, the choices that we make in our life affect that, our sedentary lifestyle and our eating choices. But, you know, if you look at some of these numbers, I mean, up to 61% of patients that have an amputation die within 2 years, and 78% die within 4 years. Those statistics are worse than most major cancers, more than breast cancer, that it gets a lot of attention where this gets none.
Well, and since you brought it up, why is that? Why is it their life expectancy dropping because of the amputation, or is it just the natural progression of what's happening?
So clearly it's not just because of the amputation. Okay. It's the disease, the vascular disease process. And so getting back to what you were talking about with, you know, what do you do? Well, the answer really isn't just fixing the blockage. That's temporizing things. That's just...
You go back to root cause, yeah.
Yeah, you got to go back to really where, what is it? Well, you know, you can get fast food so quick and easy. It's loaded with, most of it is carbohydrates. So you're this high carbohydrate diet that over time really affects the disease process. You know, there was a physician who was looking at kids in the Honduras and kids in the U.S. and eating and what their insulin levels and glucose levels do. And so, you know, we were made to not eat all the time. We were made to eat only at certain times when there was food that was plentiful. And over time, now food is plentiful all the time. So if you look at kids in the Honduras, they eat three meals and they spike their glucose levels and their insulin levels accordingly. And over the years, as they get older, they maintain this because they've maintained that eating habit. Whereas in the U.S., you see kids start out that way, but then they start having higher and higher levels of glucose and the spikes get less and less because they're constantly eating. I mean, what kid doesn't go to school? And heaven forbid if you didn't give them snacks to take. Right. I mean, when we went to school, you ate breakfast in the morning, and that's if you got up in time. And then you ate your lunch, and then you ate dinner when you got home. And so we've kind of created this hyperglycemia, and this sugar is toxic to the blood vessel walls and can lead to this. Now, I'm not saying that's the only thing, but it's the direction we've been going, and unless we reverse those things, which are much bigger than some of these other things,
What percent of your, if you can, it doesn't have to be an accurate percentage, but what percent of your patients do you think actually change and modify their behavior, their eating patterns and things like that after being diagnosed or treated or whatever it is? And how many just say, well, you know, this is how I've always done it and I'm just going to continue? And that might be what's actually contributing to that high mortality rate after.
You know, we see probably the thing I see the most that gets changed is smoking. We don't really have that many smokers. I mean, we have a lot of former smokers, but people tend to stop the smoking. The diabetes, they feel like this is something I'm stuck with. I go see my doctor. There's a lot of diabetics don't even check their glucose levels regularly, and now they have little monitors you can put on the skin that continuously check. That part is really tough. I'm taking my medicines. And they expect that
they think that the medicine's going to, right.
So, but we do see some that really do work. And I think some of these newer diabetes medicines that are out there now, I mean, I'm seeing the hemoglobin A1C number that we check to see gives you kind of a 6-week picture of where they stand. I'm seeing folks that have been 10 or 11 and you want that under 7, under 6, if you can really get it. I'm seeing folks come back and lost 40 pounds and these numbers are better. Did they change their eating? Not really. They just changed their medication is controlling them better. I don't know whether long-term that's really good or not. I think if you need to really kind of see how these patients' insulin levels are to see if they've really kind of gone back.
Yeah. What kind of strategy do you take with them? Are you put the fear of God in them?
Well, I try to.
Or are you more accommodating and nurturing
in your approach? Well, you know, unfortunately for a lot of these folks, they're past that point where even these changes aren't going to make a huge difference. But we do talk about restricting carbohydrates, getting your hemoglobin A1C numbers down. If you're smoking, stop smoking. Getting them on just a walking program, just simple walking 30 to 45 minutes a day can really make a difference in your overall cardiovascular health, not just for the legs. So we do talk about those things, and it's just variable. Most patients will leave the office shaking their head yes, but when they come back, it's not infrequent that circumstances have kept them from.
Does it frustrate you that here in the US, I've looked at a lot of food packets since I came over. I'm an accountant, so I'm a little bit geeky. But I look at like cereal packets from the UK and here in the US, same brand, same product, allegedly, ingredients very, very different over here compared to the UK. A lot of extra things put in there that when you got E's and stuff being put before numbers and stuff, that kind of puts off right. an alarm bell.
I noticed that too, not comparing it to the UK, but just over the years, how many more additives and other ingredients are in certain foods.
I avoid that kind of thing. I'm wondering from your perspective, from what you're seeing here and how you're trying to prevent this, do you and your colleagues, are you seeking to lobby at a federal level to go, look, we want things changed. We want food ingredients changed because this will help society. So actually you reduce this number of people who are enduring pad, et cetera. Or is that just too far?
Well, I know there are some physicians that are out there that are really pushing this. A lot of them are talking about the food pyramid really isn't correct and that we need to change some of that. But a lot of this is just, it's been this way for so long. And there's a lot of different groups of doctors that disagree with maybe what should be done or what is correct. And I'm kind of in the camp of I believe we should be eating more meat. It's not, meat has been really, we've been told it is the bad actor. And I think some of that really is not causal. It was relational. Look at some of the drugs we have. We have people on statins and they keep telling us, you got to get the cholesterol lower, it used to be under 130, then it was under 100. Now they're saying you need to be under 70. Well, we have all these patients on statins and people are still dying from the heart attacks. That's not fixing the problem. And
yeah,
we make cholesterol in our body. I'm not aware of any chemical that we make that actually kills us. Mm-hmm. So if we're making that, and we need it. All our cell membranes, everything needs that. Mm. Somehow we have a disconnect there, whether that's pharma, big pharma maybe part of it, whether that's that we just need to do better research to understand the problem. I think that's
part of better research that's that's not funded by particular lobbying industries, because again, that's I think part of the problem. I can't really blame consumers too much. Certainly if you're going to go hit the dollar menu, although they're probably post-pandemic there's no more dollar menus anywhere. It's $3 menus, but there's so much confusing information out there that's sponsored by different groups that have a vested interest in selling more, that even some of these big organizations, American Diabetes Association or Heart Association or whatever, they're an organization that needs money and they take sponsorship dollars. And sometimes the things that they're recommending at least seem to be not congruent with what either common sense says or what your doctor might be telling you. There's a lot of information there.
Well, and the closer you get to the source, I think the better you're going to be, right? I mean, if you're pulling vegetables out of good soil, right? I mean, that's probably a good thing.
Yeah,
and you've got meat that's well-fed, right, and not pumped full of stuff that's exotic and could be bad for you. But let's get into your PAD early detection. So can it be detected early?
It can be, and it's fairly simple. I mean, you can feel pulses. So generally, if you can feel pulses, the skin looks normal, people have hair on their feet, generally that's all a good sign that there's enough circulation.
Let me look real quick.
Yeah, we're good. Hair on your palm?
I don't even know what to say.
I don't know,
about
you
that.
Want to check?
But if there's a question, then there's a simple test that can be done where you measure blood pressures in the arms, you measure the blood pressures in your legs, and that can give you an idea. We look at that index, and that index should be about greater than 0.9. then you know that's good. Unfortunately, in diabetics, they get calcified blood vessels, so you can't actually get a good squeeze to for that to work. So then you can rely on a pressure at the toe, which can be a good indicator, but that can be really highly technician dependent and environmentally dependent. So if you're in a cold room, your blood vessels are going to squeeze down a little bit in the toe, so that may not be as reliable. So you have to keep those things in mind. But that's a simple, easy test that can be done and that can give you a pretty good indication. If that looks abnormal, if there's suspicion after that, you can do an ultrasound test. We can image the blood vessels very well nowadays, so that's pretty non-invasive. Same technology they use to look at babies. We're looking at the blood vessels, and you can get a good idea of what's going on with the blood vessels there. So it's really driven by symptoms. So if you're really suspicious based on the patient's symptoms, then these simple tests can give us an idea of what you have, and then you kind of put the two together to determine, do we need to do something here, or do we, you know, really try to hone in on the risk factors and watch you? Because just because you have it doesn't mean that you need to have it treated. You can live with this without any intervention in a lot of instances. So,
what triggers an amputation or a recommendation for an amputation? And then going further than that, what are the options for the patient who's been told that?
So really it's tissue loss. So if you have a non-healing ulcer, especially if that ulcer is getting infected, or you have the development of gangrene, usually it's a dry gangrene, so it's not this rapidly spreading infection that people always think of, but it's a black toe. And it's now the whole toe's black, and now the second toe's starting to get black. That progression is that tissue is starting to die off. It takes a lot more blood flow to heal than it does to maintain. So if you're not getting enough, it just sort of cascades. So that is generally what triggers, hey, this is really an emergency now. We need to see what we can do. And traditionally, trained as a surgeon was to operate and perform a bypass, just like they do heart bypasses. Same thing, we would do bypasses in the leg. But unfortunately, in diabetics and in renal failure patients in particular, those smaller blood vessels are the ones that are the most diseased, and you may not really have any good bypass options. So you could have somebody come in with a black toe that's never had a problem with their foot, has no bypass options, and several months later you're taking their leg off because that was it. Now we have some endovascular options where we access the blood vessel through a needle puncture, and we can run wires and make a channel through that blood vessel and open that up. Our problem is we got to try to keep that open. But if we can get it open and make it stay open long enough for them to heal, then maybe they've got enough blood flow to maintain, or it's something we've got to do surveillance on and maintain it ourselves if needed. So that's our options. On the endovascular side, we have several different things. We use balloon angioplasty a lot, where we put a balloon in the space and expand that channel. We use devices that can shave the plaque off to kind of create a hole, modify that plaque to allow the balloon to expand better. There's newer things you can put stents in. Generally, we don't put stents in below the knee. They just tend to not work that great. But there is some evidence that some drug-eluting stents may work better than others. They're working on some drug-eluting stents for below the knee. There's some temporary stents that dissolve over time so that it gives you a scaffold to hold things open, and then that foreign body's gone. So to minimize that foreign body inflammatory reaction.
I hear that term a lot, inflammatory. That seems to be the big enemy to a lot of wellness challenges that people have, right? Inflammation, right, in the body coming from at all levels, from a cellular level, vascular level, etc. Can you talk a little bit about what kinds of things can be done to reduce inflammation, other than we talked about food? But cryotherapy, water plunge, and those kinds of things.
Those things, they can show something. I think really, though, the big thing is diet. A low inflammatory diet can really make a big difference. So something like a kind of a ketogenic diet, it's basically a low carbohydrate diet for most folks.
High fat, low carb, right? Mm-hmm. And then you're trying to eliminate sugars along the way.
And then I think the other thing to eliminate are a lot of oils. So a lot of these seed oils are actually pretty inflammatory for folks. And I think we're finding that more and more, that maybe the old lard was actually a better option than some of these seed oils that can have, nuts can have a lot of inflammatory components. And so when you're compounding that into an oil, so things like olive oil or avocado oil tend to be less, but some of these cotton seeds, peanut oils, those things can be pretty inflammatory.
Wow. Okay. The number of people that come and see you to avoid amputation, do they then avoid amputation?
A lot of them do. A lot of them.
Majority?
I think the majority do at first, but this is a disease and evolution, and over time we wind up losing the battle. And I've had some patients that have done great and continue to do great. They've changed their risk, modified their risk factors, and they can do well. Ones who really don't, we're not going to make a lot of progress. But my feeling is, we had a woman who came to see us from Fort Worth because she came to see a podiatrist, and she had a friend down here, and this podiatrist had saved her leg. So she'd already lost one leg, and she was losing her other leg. She'd had a couple of bypass operations. She was told, this is it. There's nothing that can be done. You need to lose this leg. Well, if you lose two legs, it's pretty devastating. One is bad enough. The podiatrist sent her over to me, and we basically got through her old native blood vessels, got her open. She did great for about 6 months. And then she reoccluded everything. We got her open again. She was good for about 3 months. We got her open again. It's about a month. We went back in about a month. And at that point, we're like, this is really it. So, but for her, she lived another over a year with her leg, and that was her only leg she had. Mm-hmm. And I think, that's the other devastating part, is that there is such an economic impact on the person that loses a leg, because now you what if it's a leg that you use for the gas pedal? You've got to learn to redrive. Maybe you can't drive anymore. It's harder to transfer. You're more prone to falls. You may have to modify your house so that you can get in and out of your house. And in some cases, like Medicaid, which tends to be the healthcare for the more indigent of our society, doesn't even pay for a prosthesis. So now you're taking somebody who is the most vulnerable, that has the least opportunity to get back to getting a prosthesis and being able to continue on. So just for as long as you can save that leg, I think, you keep doing what you can. And I think that's what any of us would want if we were faced with
that. Definitely. It seems like you're on a crusade, and what an incredible piece of work you're doing. It must really frustrate you and upset you that, 85% of amputations could be avoided. I mean, that must really get to you. Like, you're trying to do everything you possibly can to help people to avoid it, and then there's such a high percentage that could have been avoided if they come and seen people like yourself.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's part of the whole awareness thing, is that, and in the past, there really wasn't a lot to do, right? I mean, when I was telling you, somebody with a black toe would come in and they're losing their leg. So getting people out of that old thought and thinking that, hey, there are things, is part of what we need to be doing.
And do you see, we touched on earlier, when you started your training, it was classical, you described it as, and the pace of change now, technologies going on. Are you seeing more and more new technologies come to the fore, and you're like, I'm getting excited about this. This is really going to help what we do. And what's it look like now, maybe in 5 years' time, of some other things that are maybe coming online here?
Yeah, who knows for sure. There are definitely other things. I think the most exciting things will be things that we can do to modify those risk factors, because if we can get those, even if it's in conjunction with what we do, if we can get some of that inflammation down at the time that we're doing a procedure, that may help with us maintaining that. So I think those things, there are different newer technologies. Now there's a totally percutaneous bypass where you run the bypass conduit through the vein that runs alongside, and then you pop in and out of the artery and put stents in there so this thing bypasses the blood vessel.
Have you seen any advancements through artificial intelligence? I know we talked to a lot of business owners, and they're just now starting to use AI in their businesses. Are you finding ways of using that in your practice?
Not really. I mean, I am using it for certain things. Like I use it for preparing for patient handout material. I will ask it, put in my parameters, and it'll spit something out that's pretty good. I can go in and edit it and get it done, you know, within an hour, as opposed to something that might take hours to do. So it saved me on that. We use it actually for appeal letters with the insurance. I'll ask it to write me a letter with these things and cite literature, and you can actually get an appeal letter sent to the insurance company. What we're looking at right now in the practice is trying to use an ambient AI so that I can have a conversation with a patient. It's recording, and it transcribes that into an actual patient note that can save me. Number one, it records the conversation, so you're documenting exactly what you talked about, and then transcribes that into a note that then is part of the becomes the record.
So a lot of time saving stuff.
More time saving. There's a big a journal that did a whole expose on AI for vascular, and I came out of that with, okay, there's a lot of things, but nothing's really changing.
Yeah, because radiologists, I know they talk about how now they're using AI to go and look at things that they may have missed when they're looking at X-rays or whatever, but the AI is looking at very minute.
And I think, there may be some things where we can get some genetic profiles on patients. We know some people respond to certain medications better than others, and so we may be able to feed that into the computer and let it tell us, hey, use these combination is going to work better for this patient. So there's some things down there that it's going to change what we do.
What kind of industry challenges are you guys facing right now with respect to your type of business?
So I think the biggest thing we face is reimbursement. You know, we're seeing private practice physicians basically being driven into private equity groups, being bought out by the hospitals, and it's harder and harder for the individual physicians and small groups to just beat back all the bureaucracy that you have to do. I mean, it used to be when I first started out in private practice, I would get a note from the primary care doctor and it would have, what was going on with the patient. Now when I get a note from the primary, and that was maybe 2 pages. Now when I get a note from the primary care doctor, it's like 10 pages. And there's all these questions about that they have to ask in order for them to meet whatever metrics they have to meet for them, none of which, and there may be one line that says refer to vascular surgery. Sometimes I'm not even sure why it was, but because I was the afterthought. I was the thought at the time, but when they have to sit down and do that note. So it's harder for the individual physician to do that. We're seeing them go to hospital practices. We're seeing them, we've seen private equity going, and I've had some conversations with private equity, and I've asked the question, so why are you investing in an industry where the reimbursement keeps going down, the costs keep going up? How are you making that work?
Justify that, yeah.
And their answer is that, well, there's still a lot of fat in the system, and we get the right places, we can we can improve, you know, economies of scale, and that works. And we can park that money in these practices for a while, and then we can move our money out. So it's not, they're really not in it to try to fix things or make it better.
I have friends who are specialists that moved out of that their areas of practice because of private equity. They said it got to the point where they weren't really practicing the way they wanted to practice, the way they used to practice, and there's a lot of red tape, and even how you discuss treatment or challenges with a patient is monitored, because you don't want to put the private equity parent company at risk by saying something that might open the firm up to a lawsuit or something like that. Whereas before, you know, doctors were freer to be real, right? As they say, with their patients.
Well, and I mean, they're looking at, like, for us, they're looking at conversions. How many patients are actually getting procedures, because we're in a fee-for-service world, and that's what pays. So they want you to do procedures. Yeah. And they want you to use the least amount of stuff. Well, you know, they come to you and ask you about your conversion rate. Well, my answer was always, well, we're converting everybody that needed it. And yeah. So whether that number is 10% or 25%, well, you have a colleague that's 35%. I don't know. I didn't see those patients.
The industry kind of overview you gave there felt a little bit bleak.
Yeah.
You've stepped into a practice just recently, bucking that kind of trend. Why? And do you regret it?
Well, I think mostly because I was part of a practice for a short period of time that was, did have capital venture capitalists in it. And it just really was frustrating. And so I felt like having control over my life, the practice pattern, the folks that I want to hire to work with, all of those things is worth it. And maybe it's going to come down to where we're going to get squeezed out in the end. But, you know, I'm towards the end of my career. I'm not new into it. So I just, if I can make all that work and take care of patients the way that I feel like they need to be taken care of, then I'll go out that way.
Mm-hmm. No regrets, though, for doing what you did?
No regrets. I mean, we're still juggling.
Ask you in a few months?
Yeah, ask me.
Is there something in the naming with espada, meaning sword, that, you know, taking on the big battle?
Yeah, I wanted to stick with something.
I'm sorry,
kind
for those of you from the UK or Anglos, espada means sword.
Right. Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah,
yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you.
It's one of the missions.
Yeah, we didn't use that off the coast of France. Yeah.
You know. Espada Park. Yeah.
And my family has a tie to this city. We've been here since 1715. So, in fact, a lot of the downtown area was at least colonized by our ancestors. So I wanted to kind of stick with something San Antonio, and I just kind of felt that the espada, where, you know, it's a sword, we're fighting the disease, and kind of went with that.
Great. Right.
Love I like that.
Yeah.
All right, Doc. Well, if folks want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
So they can call our office, 210-540-6766. We have a website, espadasa.com. Those are the easiest. We're on social media as well. So any of those platforms, we can be contacted.
All right, love it. All right, that's going to do it for this episode. Quick reminder, check out our latest podcast and catch video version of the show anytime by visiting our website at satalkradio.com. That's going to be it for us. You guys have a great week. We'll see you on the next one. Good job, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.